Welcome to Drunk as a Poet on Payday. I'm your host, Jason Gray. Today's guest is Lisa Ampleman, author of, most recently, Mom in Space, as well as the books Romances and Full Cry, and the WIC Chapbook Award-winning I've Been Collecting This to Tell You. We have that WIC Chapbook series connection in common, and I'm delighted to recently find out that Kent State will be hosting a 40th anniversary celebration of the WIC Poetry Center in September this year. Individually, Lisa's poems have appeared in many journals like 32 Poems, Image, Poetry, Shenandoah, Southern Review, and The Rumpus. And in 2022, she was awarded an Ohio Arts Council Individual Excellence Award. Lisa is the managing editor of the Cincinnati Review and also the poetry series editor for Acre Books, a press that's been putting out fantastic collections. I was very excited to speak to Lisa as we both share a fascination with spaceflight and astronomical happenings, and I'm so happy to release this podcast on the day of the solar eclipse. Finding poems about subjects that excite you is always great, but Lisa also writes about motherhood and fertility issues, things that I could never completely identify with. But the great thing about these poems is that even though that's true, she engages me in the dilemma and joy of being a mother, regardless of my physical ability to access those things. Lisa begins the show by reading her poem, Birth.
Birth. The rocket-powered vehicle trails umbilicals snapped loose by its climb. Cables, pipes, and hoses that rivered in or drained hazardous gases. Arm that connected the white room to claustrophobic pod. Oh, explosive bolts, thunk subtly in the hullabaloo of the engines. Dear shear pins, shaved off as the launch system rises, unhurried, be divided. Hustle, little one, gasp out an eddy of steam. Now loose, you'll still make us wary about fever, oxygen valves. An object in flight can oscillate itself to destruction, we know, but this severing is necessary. This schism is sweet.
Lisa Ampleman, welcome to the show. It's a thrill to have you here as a guest. Thank you for reading that poem, and congratulations on Mom in Space. It's such a great book. I really enjoyed it, and I'm a big space nerd. And so it means a lot to me for a lot of reasons, not just that, but that's always fun for me to read good poems about space. So tell us about Mom in Space. How did it come to be? How long were you working on it? What was that process like for you?
First of all, thank you for the invitation to talk today and for your kind words about the book. I always love meeting other space nerds. There's a Facebook group of people called Space Hipsters.
Okay. I like that term.
So there are a handful of poems in this book that started around 2013, 14, 15, but not very many. Because what happened was in late 2019 and early 2020, the Cincinnati Museum Center here had a display related to the Apollo 11 capsule, which was on tour while the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum was being renovated. And along with that, they had a handwritten speech by Neil Armstrong as part of the exhibit. And he was a member of the board there. And
nice.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He retired to Cincinnati. He taught at the University of Cincinnati in the engineering department. And I feel like I'd known some of that before. But I just started diving in. In the gift shop, I took note of some of the books there. And in February 2020, I was headed to a residency and I wanted to bring something to read. So I brought this really thick book, Man on the Moon by Andrew Chaikin, about the Apollo program. And even though my grandfather was involved in the space program through McDonnell Douglas, it was long before my time. Even though I grew up in St. Louis, which also has a history with aerospace, there was a lot I didn't know. And I was just fascinated. It read almost like a narrative. And so when I finished that book, I was like, well, what happened next? I want to read about Skylab. I want to read about the shuttle system. And so I requested a bunch of books. And then it was March 2020, at exactly that time. Yeah. So I had a lot of time at home to read. So, yeah, I mean, you can see some of this in the book. I was working through the experiences of, you know, being at home under lockdown with a 4-year-old and, you know, kind of moving forward with my interest in space. And so for the next 2 years, I wrote, because I had a lot of time to write because I wasn't going anywhere. A lot of what I worked on ended up kind of coming through the lens of spaceflight. Not always, but a lot of it. And then the other piece is that finally, by that time, I was ready to process some things that had happened around, you know, 2013, 14, like I mentioned, and again in 2017, 18. About experiences of infertility and pregnancy loss and miscarriage and things like that. And I felt more comfortable doing it because I was at home alone in my office, in a way. I was ready to do it psychologically, et cetera. But I think that experience really shaped what the book became.
Okay. Right. I mean, the book is really deeply concerned with, you know, not only space, but also motherhood, infertility, you know, things like that. How was that experience of like writing about these difficult subjects, but, you know, and also, but bringing those things together? I mean, that's the interesting thing about them. They're not just space poems. They're not just motherhood poems. They weave in a very interesting way. I'm pretty fascinated about how one does that.
It was almost like a way of meditating on the ideas in a different way. Like in Birth, for example, that one kind of came once I realized that the pipes and things connected to the shuttle or to spacecraft, they're called umbilicals. Right. And so that language was all there right away. The moon is seen as a fertility symbol in a lot of ways, and connected to, women's bodies, and so, you know, that it was there to start with just in culture in a way, but at the same time, it was a way of not sidestepping the emotional material, but, giving it a different weave. I think that what you said is a good way to think about it. Like, so that, you know, it was more of like a bath towel instead of like a crochet thing with holes in it. Crochet is great. I don't want to make it sound like it's not, but yeah, but just a different fabric when I was able to bring it together emotionally in that way.
Oh, great. I feel like I should tell the listeners that behind, you're in your office and behind you on your wall is a wall-sized photo from the moon of the Earth. What mission was that taken on?
Apollo 17. So this is the Taurus Littrow Ridge. It's a kind of a zoomed in picture of the background. And then the Earth is not really that size. It's a much bigger than it would be proportionally, but it's quite stunning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but it's cool. I was like, oh, look at that. You already have that on your wall. It's awesome.
I love it.
What else? I mean, you know, you mentioned your dad had worked for McDonnell Douglas. I mean, is that kind of where you started? Were you like a space kid? Like, did you grow up? No.
I mean, not at all, surprisingly. Yeah. So I can remember going over to my grandfather's house. It talks about this in the book a little bit, but he was a buyer for McDonnell Douglas in the 60s and 50s. And so he bought a couple things for the Mercury capsules. And then he was on a team of buyers for buying everything for the Gemini capsules. but I didn't talk to him about that until recently. And I wasn't obsessed with space in the way I am now until 2020, until that exhibit and the residency and reading that book and kind of having that experience. My dad worked for McDonnell Douglas as well later in software. And it just is a big, now it's Boeing bought them.
Right,
so it's a
right.
big, yeah, it's a big part of the area. But it wasn't something I thought about until I was reading. And one of the things that happened in St. Louis that I didn't realize until, you know, February of 2020 when I was reading, is that one of the Gemini crews was killed in a plane crash at the St. Louis airport, kind of, you know, breaking into the building where the Gemini 9 capsule was being built. And so, you know, I actually reached out to my grandfather at that point and started asking him questions in a way I hadn't before. And I kind of regret now not being interested earlier because, you know, I could have tried space camp and things like that before I was creaky and older and all of that. But yeah, no, it's a very, very recent thing. And this, the wall here, we moved here in 2021 after I was already interested in space. My husband, we weren't looking to move, but my husband saw this and he saw the rest of the house and we were like, yeah, let's go take a look at that.
So that was at the house already?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, wow. Yeah. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, meant to be. That's great. Okay.
I call it the moon room.
Well, there you go. That's awesome. I'm jealous. I mean, I like my bees behind me, but
oh, they're great. Yeah,
and a big like, wall size picture from the moon. I actually did go to Space Academy when I was a kid. When I was in seventh grade, I was very lucky to get to go.
Yeah.
Actually, you have a poem in your book, and it's funny. It reminded me a lot of that. I'm gonna pull it up here. Oh, no, this one was about the Starfish Prime. All right, it doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah, Starfish Prime. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I've been trying to write a poem about Starfish Prime for a while. And so when I got to that point in the poem, Supermommy, I was like, oh, here we go, yes. But when I was in Space Academy, I had a crush on I was in seventh grade. There was a ninth grade girl on my team from Toms River in New Jersey, which has a lot of problems with cancer, especially in children. And you had a poem in there that sort of referenced that, you know, cancer things too and stuff. And that's what I was like brought back to that immediately.
I think there's definitely overlap in this, you know, thinking about the space program, thinking about pollution and environmental concerns, thinking about in a small way, you know, nuclear production and how that connects to all that as well, even though that was more in some of the unmanned, like the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 programs.
Well, that's right, because they used uranium fuel, I think, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Well, let's hear another poem.
Sure.
Could you read Breaking the Wheel for us?
Breaking the Wheel. As a child, I lived on St. Catherine Street, patron saint of unmarried girls and knife sharpeners, spinsters and spinners, strapped to a spiked wheel for torture when she wouldn't consort with the emperor, she shattered it with her touch. Impatient, the executioner took her head instead. At one end, St. Catherine Street becomes green grass. In the middle, we sledded down the front yard hill, whooping with joy or terror. The street dead ends near Coldwater Creek, with its concrete banks and nuclear secrets, runoff from radioactive waste leached into its water decades ago. The kids who played on its banks, my mother never let me, have salivary gland growths, thyroid tumors. In one treatment, neutron therapy, the radiation takes away from what it gave. In the room, a vault, the photons bounce off a bit of beryllium, and the tumor's DNA dances in the ray, cannot cope. The cell breaks, defeated wheel. For years, the official word was no link between their illness and the creek. Now the state sifts the soil. Thorium lurks a few feet down. Don't breathe it in, the researchers warn. No landscaping or tilling here. Use caution. We can clean this up. Caravaggio's Catherine holds a sword, her dress sleeves white against the dark shadows of her skirts. The wheel is broken behind her, two spokes with empty couplings. An unbroken halo curves around her head, barely there, gold that might float away on the lightest exhalation.
Thank you. That's terrific. So yes, that's the poem that referenced cancer, and, you know, as it related to things with space. It brought me back to my own space camp adventure and schoolboy crushes. But also, I love that this poem has Caravaggio in it, and one of my other big loves is visual art. So just bringing these things together, it's a terrific poem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then the other aspect of this book that I found really interesting is that you have in the middle of it, this personal essay, you know, which is sort of an unusual move in a book of poems. And I wonder, you know, how you came to that decision to sort of mix genres to include that. And I wonder if anyone now feels like they have to contend with life studies at that point doing that move, but maybe not. I mean, we might be so far beyond that book and other people having done it that it isn't the sort of big thing to deal with. But anyway, I'm just curious about why you went that route, you know.
Yeah. I mean, describing it in relationship to life studies makes sense to me, not after the fact in a way, because I actually mentioned that when I was sending this to my publisher as a model in my mind after the fact for why it was there. And there's a much shorter lyric essay at the beginning too, that almost looks like a series of prose poems. And a couple things that happened to bring this together. One was that the essay in the middle is about Neil Armstrong, quite a bit, as well as, you know, some of the only other experiences that we've talked about, and a chronic illness I have. And when I tried to work on some of those elements in poetry, it didn't work. It wanted to be an essay. And at the same time, the essay felt so closely connected with the poems that I wanted it to kind of sit together with them. In my reading life at the time, I was looking at books by poets that kind of straddled the line between poetry and nonfiction. I think of Victoria Chang's book, Dear Memory. Yeah. So I think about Victoria Chang's Dear Memory, which is Letters on Writing, Silence, and Grief. It's, you know, technically prose, but it's poetic in a way that helped me kind of sit there. And I've seen more and more poets writing nonfiction, sometimes separate from their poetry. And, you know, a handful who, you know, mix both in the same collection. Or it's a hybrid of both, and it's hard to tell which is which. Mm-hmm. So Pragita Sharma has a collection called Grief Sequence that could be taught in a nonfiction class or a poetry class. And, you know, obviously, you know, there, historically we could think about the way in which the prose poem started and blah, 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 blah. But the current contemporary essay is doing different things than a prose poem does. Yeah. You know, there's definitely crossover in the lyric essay. Danielle Cadena Doolin has a book out recently in which one of the final poems is a really long one that feels like a verse essay or something like that. And so I just see this richness happening, and then the material itself wouldn't fit with kind of what the way a poem works, right, line by line, et cetera.
Right. Verse essay. I like that term. I don't know if I've heard that before. That's great. Well, let's thinking about that. Like, so I'm very curious about every poet's sort of what I would referred to as the theory of the line, like, you know, how we were talking about prose, but also, you know, how do you, when you're writing a poem, a lineated poem, like, what is it that you're thinking about when you're crafting a line? And because you're, you know, you have various lengths, various different kinds of lines in this book. It's a pretty varied book in that way. And so I'm curious, like, what is it to you? Like, how do you conceive of it when you're setting out to write a poem?
Yeah, I love that question. And I love the chance to kind of think about that a little bit as well. I definitely use, for a poem that's stalled out, I'll use a different shape on the page, different line breaks, different form, as a method of revision. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I think my overall philosophy chimes most with Denise Levertov's on the organic form. I don't know if I believe about that there's like this, it's almost like Platonic, like there's this perfect form and we just bring right. it into being.
Sure.
But I like the way that she talks about the stanzas as distinct units of awareness and form as a revelation of content. So, you know, a poem I might read later, Lava Tubes on the Moon, that was definitely one that got stalled out. And I found myself trying it over and over again in different ways, including taking content in, adding content, taking it away. And then I thought, well, what if I try longer lines? Because I don't have a lot of poems with longer lines. And yet kind of get that emptiness in a way. And so on the page, the poem has some long lines, but then the last line of a stanza ends toward the left margin and the next line starts toward the right margin. So there's this like tube of emptiness in between. And so, you know, sometimes that kind of like form and content argument right. that, you know, literature teachers sometimes try to use to help students understand poetic forms and that sort of thing. Sometimes that's in my mind. Mm-hmm. And then other times, it's just how things fall into place. To kind of go back to Levertov, and I'm going to pull this out and read a quote from her. This is in On the Function of the Line, which is from 1979, which is the year I was born. So hey, I love this nice. For many reasons. The most obvious function of the line break is rhythmic. It can record the slight but meaningful hesitations between word and word that are characteristic of the mind's dance among perceptions, but which are not noted by grammatical punctuation. And she says the line break is a form of punctuation additional to the punctuation that forms part of the logic of completed thoughts. So it's almost like I talk about syntactical rhythm mm-hmm. sometimes when I'm talking poems with people. And so it's another rhythm on top of that in a way as well. There one more thought I had. Oh, she called it a half comma. So when she read her poems, she would think of, line break as a half comma as far as pacing would go. So, okay. But yeah, I definitely think it's another way of patterning and making language kind of more careful and examined. And so like if you have a very short line of just a couple words, it better be strong and not right. of the night or something yeah. like that. Yeah. As a way to introduce different ways to read and different ways to feel, which I think is even more important for me as a reader of poetry.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Yeah. That's great. Thank you. It just fascinates me. Like I sort of grew up writing very metrical verse, and that's how I learned and I like and writing that way. And so pre-verse styles was, you know, not something I learned right away. And so I'm always sort of very interested in when people are doing that or these different things, like, how are they doing that? Like, I know when my line ends, you know, kind mm-hmm. of thing. So, mm-hmm. So it's always just so fascinating to me. I I was always a fan of James Longenbach's writing on the line. I thought he was really good at that. I learned a lot from him.
Yeah.
So I got one more question for you.
Yeah.
So, little easy question. So lastly, you know, since our victories in poetry are often few and far between, and you've published a new book, and that's a great one. So how are you celebrating?
Oh, that's a great question. I find it hard to do so. My book before this came out in February of 2020. Ugh. And life was so busy at the time, even before the pandemic, that I hadn't set up a launch. Mm. And so I'm trying to be more intentional about that now. LSU Press set up a Facebook Live reading, which definitely felt like a launch. And I took part in a reading series here called Poetry Stacked, which is in the library stacks of the university library. Yeah, it features someone from the community as well as students and members of the poetry faculty and staff. And that was on the publication day. So that felt like a huge thing to be reading it, but also be reading it in community with other people. And then the one thing I really wanted to do is somehow connect it with space in some fashion. And so in April, I'm going to be part of an event at the Cincinnati Observatory. Yes, I'm excited. It's a day in celebration of the acquisition of at least one of their telescopes. And so they're going to have a day full of kind of celebration things. I'm going to have a table there. I'm going to have a reading. And so to go into that kind of space, that feels like a pun, and read, sounds like exactly what I was hoping would happen.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I want to set up one more Zoom reading so I can like have the moon room that sort of thing. But I haven't figured out the details. I'd love to read with a couple people. So it's not just specifically about Mom and Space.
Oh, you should record yourself reading some poems from the book in front of the backdrop and share those on YouTube and such.
That's a great idea.
Facebook and whatnot. Yeah. That's awesome. Are you going to see the eclipse?
Yes. I am. I'm only, so if I drive about 15, 20 minutes north, I'll get like a smidge of totality from where I am. But I think I want to go a little bit deeper and have a greater chance. So I might just wait and see what the weather's like in different places. We tend to be pretty gray here that time of year, but we've had a lot of sunshine this winter. So, you know, maybe climate change will give us a better chance at seeing
one benefit.
The eclipse. Yeah exactly.
Well, good. I'm looking forward to it myself.
Good.
Well, thanks again, Lisa, for talking to me today. I appreciate it. It's been a great pleasure, and I wish Mom and Space all the success in the universe
for you. Yeah, I love it.
Would you take us out by reading another poem?
Sure. I'll read the poem I mentioned, Lava Tubes on the Moon. Just a quick backstory. I was fascinated by this when I learned about it. And so for a long time, I wanted to write a poem titled Lava Tubes on the Moon. but I wasn't sure what it would say. And then when I was able to interweave it with this content, it came together.
Great.
Lava Tubes on the Moon. Your voice saying miscarriage, because I could not speak it into being, when the nurse asked why I was having surgery. You were my windbreak, though you'd break down while you waited, and I slept through the worst of the loss. I hadn't realized you might grieve too, because it was happening inside my body, failed haven, genetic code breaking down in the dark. Our first permanent dwelling on the moon will likely be lava tubes, tunnels where lunar volcanoes flow, burn through rock. Oh, eerie cylinders, evidence of what's died out. Protect us from solar radiation. You are a church. You are a sanctuary, the priest said online, when churches close their doors against a plague this spring. But lava tubes on the moon have skylights where magma bubbled up, clerestory windows we'd need to cover to keep charged particles from changing our cells. I suspect we've never seen extraterrestrials because they know a body adapted to a particular place can't survive outside its biosphere for long. Let's stay home in sweatpants and stuff our faces with spinach dip. Let's say one more prayer from our religion for comfort. A conception is one of its central mysteries, though it's one we don't seem to master well. Left out of the miracle this time, we'll shore up the walls of the basement instead. Our storm shelter with a crack in the wall, with only a lackluster glow from glass block windows, radiation refracted from a far-flung, flaring star.
What a great talk that was with Lisa Ampleman. My thanks again to her for joining me on the show. If you're a listener in the Cincinnati area, check the show notes for a link to the Cincinnati Observatory and go hear her read live. And there are links for you to get a copy of Mom in Space and find out more about her work. Hopefully you were able to see the eclipse. I hope I did. If you enjoyed the show, connect with us on Instagram and other social sites. Leave a review. I'd love to know what you think. This was Drunk as a Poet on Payday. Thanks for listening.